If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Petit of the Royal Historical Society, and I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Professor Peter Heather. Professor Heather is Chair of Medieval History at King's College London. He is one of the leading historians of the late Roman Empire and of the ancient world. And today we are discussing his latest book, Christendom, The Triumph of a Religion, AD 300 to 1300. Welcome, Professor Heather.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Professor, why did you write this book?
I wrote it as a result, you know, I teach Christian things throughout my career, you know. So, you know, I'm now in my early 60s. I've been teaching for 30 odd years. And I felt certain hesitations about some of the ways in which Christianity was being taught, that sometimes it's presented as an unproblematic thing. We know what Christianity is. It's always the same thing. You don't have to discuss what it is. And also, I think some of the contexts in which Christian conversion were being recorded as taking place, these weren't being probed enough. And a combination of those two things made me want to stop and take a look at the process, particularly over the long term. The other thing that happens with particularly at university level, where you have periodizations and different departments, ancient history being a different department from medieval history, is that the story gets broken up into fragments. And I wanted to put everything together and think about it in the light of the sort of elements of the story that I felt weren't being fully discussed at the moment.
Would it be true to say that you do not care very much for Christianity qua as a religion?
I'm not a believer. I had my Church of England religious phase when I was a teenager. I wouldn't say that I don't care for it exactly. I've never been blessed, or whatever the right word would be, with or at least not since that phase. I've not had a kind of deep Christian faith. I still really like going to church, actually, and not very often, but occasionally. And I find some very profound truths in some of its teachings. I think the Easter message, that there's hope often in the very darkest of places, that's so true to human experience. I've found a great deal of comfort and inspiration in that over the years. And since I've had children, I've rediscovered a love for Christmas, I confess, as a great time. But if you mean that I don't have a deep personal faith, that's entirely correct. But I love a lot of the teachings, love a lot of the messages. So sort of half and half on that one, I think.
Why do you not employ the term, unless I missed it, late antiquity in the book?
I don't. Gosh, that's interesting. You're probably right. I probably am more interested in, this is one of the problems I have with the current writing on it, I suppose, in a way, in the sense that the last generation or so, particularly under that late antique umbrella, has divorced cultural historical matters from other historical matters, not least the sort of history of the Roman imperial system. And I suppose that the sort of underlying theme of the first third of the book is that the history of Christianity in the period between, say, 300 and 700 can't be properly understood unless you put it, throw into the equation the fact that it does become the official religion of this Roman imperial system, that the process of making it so not only changes the Roman Empire, but more profoundly changes Christianity as well. So, as it were, putting religion back in the context of all the other types of history that relate to the flourishing and unraveling of the Roman imperial system seems to me extremely important, rather than having the idea that Christianity is a cultural construct that functions completely outside of the sort of political economic structures of the Roman world, which I don't believe to be correct. So I didn't deliberately not use the term late antiquity, but as it were, I am very focused in that part of the book in putting Christianity much more firmly into the Roman imperial context, because I think that tells you some very important things about Christianity and the way that it's being changed don't make any sense if you don't.
Isn't that the non-usage of the term antiquity part and parcel of your disagreement with Peter Brown in terms of the issue of continuity versus discontinuity?
I don't think it's about continuity exactly. To my mind, it's about the relationship between culture and power, and between cultural structures and political structures. Peter Brown taught everybody who taught me in Oxford. When I first met him, I said, you know, I'm sort of your intellectual grandchild, and we both laughed about it, because I am. But the main distinction that I would see, the main difference in emphasis, is he wants to, and argues very cogently and with great vigor, that the history of the period 300 to 800 has been bent out of shape by talking about the rise and fall of the Roman system, and by not focusing on cultural matters within which there's much greater continuity, etc., etc., and that, as it were, the traditional emphasis on the decline of Rome as a bad thing, inaugurating the Dark Ages, that's mistaken. There's quite a lot of that I actually agree with. You know, rise and fall of systems are rise and fall of systems. They're not inherently good or bad in my opinion. You know, the things that happen within human society. And I was very much cheered by the response to the book I wrote about the fall of the Roman Empire, where sort of half of the responders, if you look on Amazon, I haven't looked for a while, so I might be slightly out of date in my numbers here, but it was about 50-50 who thought I was on the side of the Romans or on the side of the barbarians. The answer is I'm not on anybody's side. I don't think it's either a good or bad thing, but it's a thing. And where I think I really disagree, or would argue an alternative case to what Peter Brown has been the sort of underlying emphasis of his writing over the years, is in suggesting that you can write the history of big cultural structures like Christianity apart from the history of the Roman imperial system, because the case I'm making in the first third of the book, or trying to make, and of course, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, we'll see what readers make of it, is that the particular transformations that happen within Christianity, both in the fourth and fifth century, and then in the later fifth, sixth, and seventh century, are tied so closely to the rise and fall of the Roman system that you have to see it in that context, that the Roman Empire becomes what our early modern historical colleagues would call a confessional state. It is a Christian state. It nails its ideological flag to the mast of Christianity, if you like. And Christianity is absorbed into the imperial structures in administrative ways, in educational ways, in terms even of how religious authority is articulated and deployed, so that when that Roman system unravels, as it does in the western half of the Mediterranean in the fifth century, this has some very profound effects upon Christianity. So, I mean, Peter Brown has noticed and emphasized that we get the phenomenon of what he calls Christian microcosms in the post-Roman West, where you've got Christian communities that are in a little bit of contact with one another, regional-based Christian communities in Francia or Gaul or north of the Channel, but no overarching authority structure, nothing binding them together. I totally agree with him on that observation, but I would articulate and explain it in a slightly different way, and that is that the unitary authority of centralized Christianity in the Roman period is provided by the fact that the emperor provides overarching religious authority and is recognized as having the right to do so, particularly in the right to call these huge ecumenical councils, which make all the really authoritative decisions, and that when you remove the office and the person of emperor from the system, then these regional Christian communities are left without a head. And in fact, the kind of authority that emperors had exercised in the late Roman period then gets exercised by successor state kings. So again, it's kind of political structures that are dictating much of the pattern that produces these Christian microcosms. And so to talk about them without talking about the political history and the way that the rest of the sort of social and economic structures of the Roman world are evolving in the late Roman period, to me, doesn't make so much sense.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in your introduction to the book, I read it as being a sort of ad hominem attack on your predecessors, in the sense that you seem to argue that since Iri grew up and reside in a post-Christian world, I have a more discerning, I suppose, for lack of a better term to employ, view of the historical background of this period, as opposed to, say, the Christopher Dawsons of 50, 100, 150 years ago, who were unduly influenced by the Christian aspect of the society in which they resided in.
I think we all write from the perspectives in which we're situated. I tried to be a little more even-handed than that, and maybe I failed, but I'm not, I think, trying to argue that the slightly non-religious or post-Christian perspective, if you like, that comes naturally to me living where I do and when I do, is more valid, just that it is as valid, and that it's a dimension that hasn't worked its way into the scholarly literature sufficiently yet, and particularly in the sense that the sort of Christian, the standard Christian narrative is one of unfolding success, if you like, that Christianity wins because it's a better religion and it's always going to win. And certainly, I mean, I know this is much less true in America, but in a European context, and it doesn't matter whether you're north or south of the channel, but across most of Europe, that's no longer true. Christianity has lost its kind of cultural... Exactly. Its position at the center of cultural life. Lots of people still describe themselves as Christian, but they really mean Christian as opposed to anything else. And they don't go to church. They don't organize their lives around the sort of great Christian festivals. A Christian faith is not at the heart of their existence and their worldview. And I think this opens or makes me more aware of the possibility that, you know, given that we know that Christianity can lose, because it has lost in this wide European context over the last 120 years, that it might not have been successful in the past. So that's really all I'm trying to claim, or that's the sort of line of emphasis that I'm interested in bringing more to the intellectual table, as it were, a greater openness to the fact that we shouldn't take the success of Christianity for granted. The fact that it's not done so well in a European context more recently just then makes you think about the other moments when it might not have done so well in the past.
I suppose you could say that what you're endeavoring to do is bring contingency back to the narrative of the story.
Yes, absolutely. That I think there are probably two watchwords. Contingency is certainly one of the two that I would put a lot of emphasis on. And the other one is the other point that emerges from taking Christianity over the very long time frame that I do is just how, and I think it's closely related to the contingency, is just how much Christianity changed over the centuries. And it changes to accommodate new societies, new belief systems, and also to function in different ways and to become a mass religion and an organized religion. In a sense, I suppose that's my biggest problem with just the use of the word Christianity. It's a misleading singular noun. It can make you think of this thing and make you think that it's always been the same. Well, yes, there are some continuities in Christianity from as early as we have the earliest text. So we know that already by the time the epistles are being written, that they're thinking of Christ somehow as God and man, and that Christ's life and death is central to the salvation of human beings. That's a key central idea that's there from, the earliest documented time. There are lots of other ways in which Christianity has changed very profoundly, from being a small sect-type religion for very, very devout believers only, or turning into a mass religion, the kind of administrative authority structures that have to change, belief structures even that have to change to accommodate that transformation, and thinking about how as the context changes around it and different groups of European populations are brought to a Christian allegiance, then you see Christianity adapting to those groups over time.
Why did Constantine the Great convert to Christianity, and when would you hazard a guess did he do so?
That's, I think, one of the most fun questions, and it's kind of why I started with him. The only thing I think you can be absolutely certain of is that you can't believe a word he said about it. The evidence, it's not transmitted firsthand, it's transmitted secondhand through various people who met him, is contradictory. And if you line up the public religious stance of his regime, the pattern that becomes clear is that he inches his way towards Christianity, but only after every major political victory that he wins over the rivals that he faces. When he comes to power, he's one amongst, I think it's seven or eight emperors. And over time, we get this kind of Darwinian struggle. But this is the post-Diocletianic tetrarchic sort out in Roman politics. And between 306 and 324, the others are winnowed out until Constantine emerges triumphant as the sole emperor, left standing from this brutal struggle. And it's only in 324 that he unambiguously declares his Christianity to the entirety of the empire. And of course, that's the moment when it's politically safe to do so. And the pattern is that the intermediate stages that mark as a shift in regime religious policy are all inaugurated by great military victory. So that's the same, that's like declaring a difficult policy immediately after you win a huge general election victory in the modern world, but doing it afterwards, not beforehand. You don't tell people the awkward thing about you before the election. You wait until you've got the validation of victory before you say it. And in the Roman world, the validation of victory was even stronger because they believed that the divinity of whichever persuasion you chose to think the divinity was, that the divinity intervened directly in the running of the Roman world. So military victory came from God, the gods, whichever god you believed in. So that there is a huge legitimation that's brought to any victor from civil wars, and especially a victor from multiple civil wars like Constantine. He's completely untouchable in 324. My own suspicion, I'm not alone in this, is that Constantine may have been a personal Christian believer from very early on, and that there was Christianity within his family. That's based on hints rather than explicit information, but it makes kind of sense, I think. So in other words, what he tells us is the story of his conversion via these intermediaries is much more a story of him coming out as a Christian when it's politically safe for him to do so. Because at the moment that he comes to power, the rest of the Roman world is still persecuting Christians. And to have declared a Christian allegiance at that point would have been to invite every other contender for power to unite against him. So that was a completely dangerous thing to do.
How popular slash widespread was Christianity in 312 at the time of Constantine's toleration edict?
Yeah, it's a great question, that one. And it's a very important question. You can only do ballpark estimates. There's one fairly popular one, which suggests that it's already quite popular in the 10 to 20% bracket. That, I think, is completely impossible when you kind of do the ballpark calculations, in the sense that we know that Christianity is largely an urban phenomenon, and maybe only 10% of the Roman population lived in towns. But we also know that only about one third of the towns of the empire had an organized Christian community with a bishop at that point. So that takes you from 10% down to more like 3%. And actually, there's no city of the empire in 312 where Christians were the majority. Antioch is the oldest continuous Christian community of them all. The community in Jerusalem was disrupted by the Jewish revolts and the expulsion of the Jews against Roman rule in the early second century. So Antioch is the oldest Christian community of them all, but even by about 360 or 370, after the empire has been formally Christian for a generation or two, Christians are a large chunk of the Antiochene population, but they're not the majority even then. So, you know, you do those ballpark figures, you add in a bit more because we know there are some more rural Christian populations in Egypt and in North Africa in particular, also little bits of Asia Minor. But, you know, you go from 10% maximum, 3% because it's only a third, cut down the 3% because it's not a majority in any of those cities where there is an organized Christian community, add a bit back in for rural world, I don't see how you get Christian numbers more than about 1.5-2% of the imperial population at the absolute maximum. So it's still very small, I think.
Perhaps I misread you, but I got the impression that you were asserting that in terms of Christianity prior to 312, that it was sort of open-minded about theological disputes. And once it became connected with the Roman state, much less so. Isn't that a little bit reductionist?
I don't think so. I would see it this way. This is, I suppose, what I was trying to say, that the Christian world before 312 is largely composed of autonomous local communities that run themselves with very loose authority structures. There isn't a mechanism. And in fact, the hostility of the Roman state would have made it impossible for there to be a mechanism for Christians to meet together and resolve complex issues. We know that they are excluding certain points of view as unacceptable, but the kind of things they're doing are making, as it were, negative statements. So this is not compatible with Christianity. What they don't try and do before the time of Constantine is produce a strong, closely defined, positive assertion of what Christian belief should be. And obviously, the most interesting thing about Christianity in theological terms is the mixture of the divine and the human in Christ. So an awful lot of the dispute in early Christianity, pre and post Constantine, is revolving on the figure of Christ and what exactly does it mean to have God and man in the same person. But what you see after Constantine, well, really from the Council of Nicaea onwards, is that you start to see a more positive need, feeling, determination to produce a very tightly argued positive definition of what right Christian belief is. So in a sense, orthodoxy as a positive set of beliefs, that is a product of the new world that comes into being after Constantine's conversion. And I think what Constantine's conversion does for Christianity is make it possible for people to meet together, and also then gives it a new decision-making body, which is the ecumenical council. So all the sort of great statements of defined faith about the Trinity that emerge in the late Roman period, these all emerge at the discussions and via the validation of ecumenical councils, Nicaea and Constantinople, then Chalcedon, and obviously Second Constantinople in the 6th century. And Christianity had not had a decision-making body to make those kind of unified decisions before. And this is where imperial authority is important, because only an emperor can call ecumenical councils. And when we start to get more detailed evidence, as we do from the 5th century onwards, about how these councils are run, then, you know, emperors are open to influence from bishops. Bishops are absent, and theologians are putting their oar in the whole time. But emperors don't call a council until they think they've got a clear idea of what the answer is going to be. There's too much at stake. It's like holding a big international forum these days. You don't do that unless you think you know you've got the answer that you want to get through, and that it will get through. Otherwise, too much face is lost. So not only do emperors call councils, but they are actually, the imperial court is the center of all the jockeying for position that precedes the calling of a council, and the formulation of the answer that is going to be pushed through the council, because most of the time councils know what answer they're going to give. And actually then imperial authority is also used, the structures of the Roman state, to enforce the decisions that the councils make. So I don't mean it to be reductive. I'm simply observing that the incorporation of Christianity into the structures of the Roman state, gives it an entirely new authority structure, and an authority structure with much greater centralized teeth, as it were, and clearly changes the nature of the kind of decisions that Christian leaders are able to make, and they are making them through the imperial office and enforcing them through the imperial office. So I don't know, is that reductive? Whatever.
Would it be true to say that your narrative tends to endow agency only to elites? And was this more a matter of adhering to that idea, or actually an aspect of lack of evidence for the 90% of the population who were peasants or land?
I, you're absolutely right about the lack of evidence. We simply don't know, for the most part, about how and why non-elite populations pick up Christianity, particularly in the early medieval period. The whole organized project by early medieval churchmen to spread Christianity into the countryside, it would have happened sometime, but in practice, it tends to be largely a post-Roman project in the West. And you can see the initiatives that they take, those are well documented, but the how and why of the reception of those initiatives is not clear to us. So it's methodologically very difficult to get into that process. I hope I haven't ruled the sense of agency out. I'm just not able to document it. With any stimulus that's applied, you always have, as a, you know, to any group, the group always has a range of available responses to it that it can make to that stimulus, more and less negative, of course, depending on how it views those stimuli. What I've tried to do, and again, you know, there is a limit to the evidence base available. You can tell from the intensely limited Christian infrastructure that it's possible to put in place before the sort of last century or so of the first millennium. You know, very few churches in the countryside. The classic one that's always quoted is that peasants lived on average 6 miles from a church in Tours. It's Gregory of Tours diocese in 6th century Francia. Well, if they're 6 miles from a church on average, that means it's 12 miles to go there and back. And that means they're hardly ever going, because you are not walking 12 miles on your day off to go to church. Likewise, we know that there's not much in the way of educational infrastructure for training priests, or books for them to be using in churches or whatever. So the amount of Christianity that's being applied or being made available, as it were, in the countryside is pretty limited. And I've tried to suggest that agency is there, even if we can't document it in its entirety, by the fact that almost certainly, and there's plenty of evidence to support that, what people are doing is bolting on some elements of this Christian structure they're being offered in such a limited way onto whatever else they believe, whatever else their beliefs, their existing belief structures lead them to think about the cosmos and how the world interacts with greater divine powers. So you have to come at it sideways. I certainly didn't mean to think that non-elites just have things done to them. It's just very difficult actually to document exactly how they would respond.
On page 105, you compare Christianity for the post-Roman period, I suppose the particular period after 800, to quote, one party state model that operated in the old Soviet bloc, unquote, with, as you put it, quote, the vast majority choosing to join the party, unquote. Now, in fact, it's not, from my knowledge of such matters, I don't think in any communist state, or for that matter, the current Chinese communist state, was it the case that the vast majority of the population joined the party. In view of that fact, Isn't your analogy rather misplaced?
I don't think so. I mean, yeah, you're right. You don't get the choice to join the party. You have to join in the party's structures, but only about 10% of the population get active party membership. Nonetheless, the lives of everyone else is certainly shaped by it. So I don't think the analogy is completely misplaced. I'm obviously, poking a stick into the wasp's nest. But the point is, and page 105, I'm talking about the late Roman world. If you wanted to succeed, and we're talking about elite context at this point, if you wanted to succeed in the Roman world, you had to have the right connections in Roman public life, either the right job or, you know, the right chains of socio-political connection to get you the right tax settlement that you want, or get your law cases fixed in the way that you wanted, get your children the jobs that you wanted, these kind of matters. Certainly from the 390s onwards, if you were not a declared Christian, your capacity to do this was legally hampered. So if we're thinking about the analogy with the Soviet state, you know, so about 10% of the population joined the party, the elite of the Roman world is 5 or 6%. We are talking about analogous numbers. Everyone else has their life shaped by it to a lesser degree, but positive party membership in the Soviet system is, I think, equivalent to operating in the elite public life of the late Roman state, and the numbers are not completely different. And certainly the need, the requirement on you to, at least in public, go along with the declared cultural stance of the current regime, that is undeniable in the Roman context. So, all analogies are approximate. I'm in part deliberately teasing, but I don't think it's a million miles off. No, not at all.
Would it be true to say that for you, the Roman and post-Roman states were ultra important to the spread of Christianity?
Yes, that is true. And that is certainly what I think. I don't think that Christianity was destined for to become sort of mass dominant cultural structure before it enters into this very interesting and mutually transformative relationship with the Roman imperial structure, and by dint of having done that, then with the post-Roman imperial structures of the West. I think, you know, in one way, this is very easy to document, in the sense that the entirety of the Roman world goes through this kind of Christianizing process in the late Roman, late antique period. But one part of that Roman world is then subsumed into the Islamic world. And in that part of the Roman Empire, Islam overtakes Christianity as the dominant cultural form, and elite conversion to Islam follows very quickly for the same kind of reasons. The Islamic world is also a one-party state of a kind, of the same kind of, using the same kind of rough analogy, to succeed in which it is better to have a Muslim declaration of faith. People do that, and eventually, of course, Islam becomes the dominant mass religion in those areas. And the areas we're talking about are Syria, North Africa, Palestine, Egypt, bits of Asia Minor. These are the sort of beating heartlands of early Christianity, and Christianity does get replaced there. So, as it were, the reverse case of where a state structure does not remain permanently Christian immediately, I think, does enough to make us think that we should be thinking in terms of what is the relationship between Christianity and these state structures, and to think about how that advanced Christianity.
Is there a timeline which is empirically based on elite conversions to Islam in the area of the Near East?
There is the same kind of qualitative evidence for Islamic conversion as there is for conversion to Christianity amongst the pagan elites of the late Roman Empire. You get some good evidence from Egyptian papyri, and then you've got the evidence that the type of evidence being used is basically the adoption of Arabic names within converting families. You get biographical dictionaries are a huge element of medieval Islamic culture. There is, I think, a slight problem with that in the sense that where we've got a bit more evidence, the adoption of Arabic language can come a generation or so before the adoption of an Islamic religious identity. But yeah, you know, that's sort of a quibble. That puts you within the kind of right quarter, half century mark. So, you know, you don't have the full sign up sheet of when everyone converted to Islam. And there's no, Islam doesn't have a sort of conversion literature in the way that Christianity does, but there's pretty good evidence actually of more or less to within 25 or 50 years of when bulk of elite conversion is happening. Yeah.
Is not your view that iconoclasm was a direct result of Byzantium's military defeats a bit too post hoc to be believable?
Well, I struggle with that one. In the sense that I can only observe what the evidence tells me. The question is really, at what level is the dispute of iconoclasm operating? Is this a sort of society level crisis? Or is it a political level crisis? And the great oddity about iconoclasm, both first and second iconoclasm, is how little dispute it actually generates. You know, when you go in and out of periods of iconoclasm, basically you just sack the sitting Patriarch of Constantinople and everybody else signs up to the new order, whether it's an iconoclast order at the beginning or an iconodule anti-iconoclast order at the end. So the transitions are incredibly unproblematic. There's also, apart from protests involving a few monks, there's no record of mass popular unrest in response to these moves, as there certainly would be now, you know, if the Orthodox world suddenly started saying, you know, icons are idols and they are a disaster, religiously disastrous and illegitimate thing to be using in your worship, there would be a huge outcry. There's just no evidence of that. And I suspect that what we're really seeing is that this transfer of an intense Christian allegiance to the mass of the population hasn't yet taken hold. I mean, we are in the sort of early 8th century. And if we look at the rest of the Christian world, if we look at the sort of Latin West, the evidence for intense mass popular engagement with Christianity is all from about the year 1000 onwards, not as early as the 8th century. So my suspicion is that the use of icons in a liturgical context is primarily a monastic phenomenon still in 8th century Byzantine contexts. And that would make sense where most of the dispute about iconoclasm relates to monks and their certain monasteries and their response to it. The mass of the population has not yet incorporated icons into its intense forms of, or less intense forms of, Christian religious observance. Had it done so, there'd just be much more fuss.
At some point in the book, you characterize Byzantium as a regional or second tier power post 640 AD. Is this not something of an exaggeration?
I don't think so. It's something I've said before, but I'm not the only person to say it. And some people do get kind of uppity about that. But I don't think it is, actually, because if you think about what the rise of Islam does to the eastern half of the Roman imperial system, it removes three of its richest territories in the Near East, Egypt and North Africa. And it turns one of its other richest areas, which is coastal Asia Minor, you know, the home of all those ancient Greek cities from the first millennium BC onwards, turns that into a battleground. And the archaeology is quite clear that the great cities that used to exist, like Sardis and Ephesus and Aphrodisias, become Byzantine forts at best, with a few small villages around them. So the sort of vibrant society and economy of that coastal zone of what's now Mediterranean Turkey is deeply disrupted by conflict with the Islamic world. And if you can, and you can, I mean, I'm by no means the first to do this, it's been done from the 90s, 80s onwards. If you look at the sort of Ottoman Empire, which has something like the same shape, and look at its tax records, you can see that the loss of the Near East, of most of coastal Asia Minor, of Egypt and North Africa would have amounted to the loss of something like between two-thirds and three-quarters of the revenue flows of Constantinople. And in fact, you'd only have to look at the map. This is using the Ottoman tax records as any kind of, you know, icing on the cake, the simple consideration of geography and agricultural production makes the point by itself. And if a state loses between two-thirds and three-quarters of its revenue, it becomes a different kind of state. That also shows up in the kinds of things that East Roman emperors are able to do, and in particular in their relations with the Islamic superpower that's emerged on their doorstep. And in subsequent eras, it is quite straightforwardly the case that is that Byzantium is able to expand only when the Islamic world is in a period of disunity or fragmentation. And as soon as any sizable chunk of the Islamic world is put back together as a unity in the vicinity of Byzantium, then Byzantium declines again. So no, I don't think it is at all. I think it's just, I think Byzantium from 700 onwards, if you like, is as much a successor state to the Roman imperial system as the Franks or Visigoths in the West.
Would it be true to say that, unlike Chris Wickham, you seem to suggest great continuity in elites after, say, 410 AD? Why so?
Sorry, can I just ask in what context? Where are you in the Roman West? Sorry,
In the Roman West.
Yeah. I think I do. I mean, if you look at...
I think you posit a different type of, how should I put it? A different type of elites in terms of cultural style.
Yes.
More militarized as opposed to the elite style of the late Roman Empire, which was very, for lack of a better expression, intellectually oriented or culturally oriented in terms of having the proper grammatical understanding of the Latin they were speaking, which was definitely not the case post 410 or, if you like, 476 AD.
Yeah, no, sure. I see what you're asking me. Sorry, I was just being a bit slow on the uptick. The late Roman elite is civilian and bureaucratic, fundamentally. Their career structures operate around the imperial bureaucracy, which is, and in part, their local, regional, provincial social life. And to flourish in that world, they need a very particular cultural formation, which involves high-end positive literacy, not just reading, but writing as well. What we see as the Roman system unravels, is across much in the western half of the Mediterranean, is across much of the western Mediterranean, the elites remain in place. It's not, I think, true in Britain and not true in northeastern Gaul, where the archaeological evidence suggests much greater disruption. But, you know, that still leaves central southern Gaul, Spain, North Africa, Italy, where the sitting landed elite are more or less there. But yes, absolutely, their lifestyles change dramatically. The successor states that emerge, certainly by the mid-6th century, I mean, this is a process, it's not an event, that the successor states which emerge are not mini copies of the Roman Empire. They don't do large-scale taxation to support professional armies. They demand military service from their constituent landowning elites. And the surviving members of the old Roman elite, you know, grandsons, great-grandsons, et cetera, who rapidly intermarry with any incoming Franks or Visigoths or whatever as well. So it's a real cultural melding that goes on. The main thing that the state requires of them is personal military service. And the kind of high-end literacy that was necessary for elite success in late Roman context becomes much less necessary. And as any good parent knows, you spend on your children what you need to spend on them to give them the best chance in life, and you don't spend other things. So when their career structures are not revolving around high-end competency in classical literature, you don't provide that. You provide them with the other things that they now need to fit them for their life as military gentry and aristocracy in the post-Roman world. So you do get a major cultural change, yes.
What do you attribute the growth in terms of your narrative of an agency to the Pope in Rome, the Papal States? I believe it's the case that in the book, it comes rather late in the narrative, basically sometime in the mid to late 11th century.
Yes, it's such an interesting process. And when I first started working on this, it's probably the thing I least expected, to be honest. I knew the Pope was sort of significant in the late Roman period and the early Middle Ages. And Rome is, Rome is one of the oldest Christian communities of them all. In the late Roman period, the Bishop of Rome is one of the five patriarchs, who are defined as those in charge of communities that were founded by one of the apostles. But it was surprisingly late where you actually find a new recognized authority structure for Latin Christendom centered on Rome actually emerging. And I think most surprising of all, because I was pretty clear that it was quite late, was the actual process. And the process, I think, is a very interesting one. And I think it basically works this way, that in the time of Charlemagne, the Latin Christian world is still small enough that Charlemagne is basically running all of it. And the same kind of religious authority that Charlemagne's Roman imperial peers had exercised is exercised by him. And that does give a kind of unity to the Latin Christian West. But if you move the dial on a couple of hundred years beyond that, then two major things have happened. The amount of conversion in Northern and Central Eastern Europe means that Latin Christendom is much, much larger, and that therefore there is no single ruler, not even the Holy Roman Emperor, who runs enough of it to provide any kind of centralized leadership. All the bishops of France will not go to a council called by the Holy Roman Emperor, whereas pretty much every bishop used to go to councils called by Charlemagne. So you can't get that kind of unified decision-making structure because there is no emperor or king who is powerful enough by the 11th century to exercise enough authority to pull everyone into single meetings and to make them work together. So you've got that brute fact on the one hand, but then on the other hand, the kind of revamping of the church that happens in the Carolingian period creates a new class of educated cleric, both in the monasteries and in the cathedrals, who do think of themselves as belonging to a unit and want to belong to a unit. And the thing that's, I think, really exciting and interesting about the emergence of papal authority is that it is Northern European churchmen coming to Rome who transform Rome into that dominant authority. So a pope like Leo the Ninth, who's actually a bishop from Northern Europe in origin, he wants Rome to exercise the kind of unifying authority that no king or emperor can do anymore, because Western Christendom has become so big, and he is willing to think of and start to put into practice. Again, it's a process, not an event, but he certainly begins it, to put into practice the kind of changes that will actually make it possible for Rome to function as a religious authority center for this much enlarged Latin Western Christendom. And this process slowly unfolds between, about 1050 and 1200. By 1200, popes have replaced emperors and kings as the dominant religious authority, and the kind of powers that emperors used to exercise over the church in the late Roman period have now been taken over by the papacy. But it's not, as it were, a coup organized from Rome. It's actually a broader tranche of educated Latin clerics who want this to happen, because it needs to happen. If the church is to have a centralized authority structure to set standards, to validate new belief structures, then it can't be based either on emperors or kings. It has to be based somewhere else, and Rome is the only viable candidate, and they make it happen. I think it's a really extraordinary story.
To conclude, what do you overall attribute to what factors do you attribute the success of Christianity at the end of your book, or by the end of your book, I should say?
Sure. I would look at two things. First of all, there is the kind of essential positivity of the message, that, you know, there are all elements of human life which will be miserable. And I don't think there's anyone whose life is so blessed that they don't go through some of these kind of dark patches at some point in their existence. Well, the fact of mortality means that if you love anybody, there will be a time when they pass, and when you're faced with these kind of incredibly black moments. And Christianity's message is one of hope in the face of those kind of inescapable moments of blackness. So I think the positivity of the Christian message is, of course, right at the heart of the story. And of course, there's a central continuity to that. So one half of the answer is that the continuity there, and the fact that that message speaks, I think, so cogently to the realities of human existence at every level. But the other thing that I would emphasize, and the other thing that's at the heart of the book, is Christianity's capacity to change and to adapt at every level, in terms of the detail of its message, in terms of its educational structures, in terms of its delivery mechanisms, how it transmits its mechanisms, transmits its beliefs, and it wins buy-in to them. Its capacity to adapt and change over time. And I do think this is, I suppose, one of the central themes of the book is the extent to which Christianity changes, but it changes in direct response to the needs that its leaderships and its representatives perceive around them as they seek to establish its messages more strongly in different populations. They respond to those needs creatively. And in some ways, it's that capacity to adapt, I think, which makes Christianity so successful.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Heather, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Petillo. Thank you for listening to New Books in History and podcast channel New Books Network. Thank you very much, Professor Heather.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.